You are now going to listen to KAZ iBook Review with Hopeton Hay.
James Lee Burke, welcome back to KAZ iBook Review.
Well, thank you for having me again.
So in this particular book, I noticed that there was a continuation from the Robichaud novel, I believe, where there was the story of the Song of Roland.
That's correct. I'm obsessed with the Song of Roland.
Why don't you share, for those who haven't heard you interview before, why you're obsessed about the Song of Roland?
Well, the Song of Roland is an anonymous ballad, epic ballad, that has to do with the Battle of Roncesvalles. That was the French word for the area, Roncesvalles in Spanish, high up in the Pyrenees, you know, of northern Spain. And this 8th century battle involved, at least in the story, Charlemagne's army against the Saracens. In reality, they were fighting with the Basques, but someone back a long time ago had a bias against the Saracens and the Moors. But anyway, it's the chivalric tale. And it is related, of course, to the Arthurian legend of the knight errant in search of the Holy Grail. But those two poems actually indicate the mindset of what was best of the Middle Ages, aside from the gore. And I mean, it was, you know, a horrible time to be around in many ways, but a grand one in another way, namely that Dave says it is the ethos of the knight errant that saves us from mediocrity. One of my favorite passages in all of literature comes from William Shakespeare's Henry IV. And let's see, how does it go? By my troth, I care not. A man can die but once. We, O God of death, let it go which way it will. He who dies this year is quit for the next. Wow.
Wow. If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is James Lee Burke. We're talking about his latest Dave Robichaud novel, The New Iberia Blues, which is a continuation of the previous novel, Robichaud. And one of the characters that has come over from Robichaud is Chester Wimple, Smiley. And I think this one is one of the few novels that you can read where there'll be a reference to Wonder Woman on the one hand and the Song of Roland on another hand.
Yeah. Smiley is one of my greatest characters, I think. I get more mail about Smiley. My daughter runs a social network, a Facebook fan club, a readers club. And people love Smiley.
Well, because what you do, what I really like is everyone knows you don't paint your villains as all dark. And while Smiley is an assassin with the mind of a child who endured horrific sexual predators growing up in Mexico, he only kills people who hurt children.
In this book, he has a flamethrower.
One of the things I love about your novel, it might be the sort of the naturalistic writing that you do, is I can read your novel. As I'm reading it, it can put me like on a sort of on a different level mentally. It's almost like it's almost like I'm there. I mean, it's almost like I can not just imagine myself being there when you describe the things going on in a novel, especially the physical landscape, but I almost feel like I'm actually there. How do you do that?
Well, that's very kind of you to say that. I really wish I knew. I go back to Shakespeare again. Shakespeare said all power lies in the world of dreams. And I believe the best writing always comes from the unconscious, and that art is the conduit from the conscious mind into the unconscious mind. And so I think it's Jungian I remember Carl Jung, he believed in the notion of inherited memory. And I keep a notebook by my bed, right there on my nightstand, and I often write about 3:30 to 4:30 in the morning. That's when I write the best, no question about it.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is James Lee Burke. We're talking about his latest Dave Robichaud novel, The New Iberia Blues. Let me read one of my favorite paragraphs from the book to you, and it sort of illustrates what I said earlier in terms of how it can get you to a certain place. So on page 107, you write, after Cleet backed into the street and drove away, the hail stopped and the rain began. Big drops flattening on the heat trapped in the sidewalk in the street, filling the air with a sweetness like the summers of our youth. I got up and went inside and turned off the air conditioning units and opened the windows, letting the house swell with wind. Then a strange sensation overtook me. In the same fashion it had on the evening I walked without purpose to the home of Bailey Ribbons and could give no explanation for my behavior other than the fact that I seemed to have stepped into a vacuum in which the only sounds I heard were inside my head. The rain fell like drops of lead on the tin roof in the bayou. From the hall closet, I removed an old sweat-stained Stetson that had belonged to my father. I put it on and walked down to the bayou, the brim wilting with rain. I told myself I didn't know why I was standing on the bank of a tidal stream in rain that was coming down harder by the second. That wasn't true. For me, the rain has always been the conduit between the visible and the unseen worlds. Years ago, my murdered wife, Annie, spoke to me in the rain, and dead members of my platoon called me on the phone during electrical storms. Their voices hardly audible in the static. And my father, who died in an offshore blowout, appeared in the surf during a squall, still wearing his hard hat and strap overalls and steel-toed boots, giving me a thumbs up while the waves slid across his knees, the oil rig that killed him stenciled against the sky. I love that passage.
Oh, thank you.
So tell me about that passage. That, to me, that's a passage that sort of breaks the other side of reality, where you can get in a little bit of a trance, because that passage is about how the rain, in my mind at least, can create this trance that Dave goes into. It's also a passage that can get the reader into the same trance.
Well, I appreciate what you say, because that's the intention of that paragraph, namely that the rain is a form of global baptism. That said, it's a renewal of the earth. And, of course, I think we are actually composed of about 96% water.
It's, wow.
It's an humbling thought. We're big drops of water walking around. But it's the truth. In the ocean, of course, is our home. That's our birthplace. And we crawl our antecedent, you know, labored up on the beach one day, and his fins turned to feet at some point, and we were off and running. But the point is that Dave is saying, in effect, that when people, theologians, for example, scientists or philosophers, it doesn't matter, when we start looking at the reality of the world and the universe in which we live, if we are to have any understanding of it, we have to examine and accept our relationship to the clay with which we were molded.
And we're pretty much seeing the consequences, the manifestation of our mistreatment of the earth, no matter how many people deny it. But how do you identify your tortured souls? Because one of the main characters in the book, Desmond Cormier, who grew up on an Indian reservation, in the novel, director, deeply talented, but also seems to be sort of a tortured soul. Is that sort of the artist's tortured soul for your character? Or is that the tortured soul from how he grew up and made his way out, but the compromises he has to make his vision a reality?
Well, you're perception is right on target. We meet this director who was born on the Chittimacha Reservation there in South Louisiana, and he was a poor boy and a spindly one who was bullied, and then he learned to pick up weights to build his body, and he went out to Hollywood and ended up a very successful man. And he's a true artist. He's got that gift. It burns in him like a votive flame, but also he's tempted into the world of celebrity, fame, and enormous wealth. And he wants money for a good reason, to make wonderful pictures like John Ford did. He's the acolyte of John Ford. He sees Hollywood as a secular cathedral in the best way. But he allows himself oftentimes to avoid the truth about people and situations and the origins of money. And that's his undoing. And I think Hollywood's an exciting place. It's the most creative place on the planet. And people love to demean it, but I don't know why.
Well, I was going to ask you, because Hollywood has been in several of your novels. Dave's daughter, Alifair, is helping to rewrite the script for this movie that's being made. And I forgot to talk a bit about that, but Desmond Cormier is making a movie there, and it's going to be this incredible movie that's going to cost a whole lot of money, probably not make a lot of money, and he may have some issues that come from it. But I've noticed in your trilogy set in Houston/Galveston, Hollywood is a major part of it. Hollywood continues to be part now of the Robichaud novels. Talk about the reason why Hollywood has been part of your Robichaud novels and why you made that decision.
Because Louisiana has been inundated with film companies, and the state of Louisiana did something really smart. It offered subsidies of films that are filmed there within the state borders, and up to 30% of the film can get produced with Louisiana subsidies. So these guys are all over the place now. But I've had a little experience, nothing grandiose, but my point is, there's no culture more American than the culture of Hollywood. And as someone else said, the poet, forget his name, he said that California is the most American state, that everything is there, every kind of person, the whole state glows with neurosis, worse than Louisiana. It's an open-air mental asylum. But every kind of topography, mountains, the ocean, vineyards, desert, that's California. But that's America. And everything, for good or bad, every fashion, every idea starts on the West Coast and goes eastward. But our history and our literature has always gone westward. That the American novel was created by, James Fenimore Cooper. But he created the original Western story. But the search, again, is the man on horseback looking for the grail in some way. He's Clint Eastwood. Alan Ladd in Shane, Henry Fonda and Wyatt Earp, Jack Kerouac on the road. It's the same thing. That's what makes this country so intriguing. The United States is an artwork. There is no precedent for it in human history. No country in the world has built a better system. Every country, our enemies, want to emulate us. Look, the guys that bombed Pearl Harbor have baseball as their national sport. Well, I was in Amnesty International 9 years, And I discovered something very quick. What was so odd is that the countries we hate, or the people who seem to hate us, want everything that is like us. Coca-Cola, rock and roll, country music, bluegrass, jazz, every kind of sport, our clothing fashions, our hip language, but they want to be Americans. And we don't understand that. We sometimes treat these people, well, look at what they're demonized. What's being done now, the demonization of these poor people that are coming out of Central America? Yeah, I know they're illegals, but my God, what would I do? If I were in their shoes, I would do the same thing. And I understand the need to control our borders and all that kind of thing. But, my heavens, the language that's used to describe them is rapist and drug. These are lies. These are patent lies. And these guys who are telling these lies know it. And I've been around the border many years. And I lived in Mexico, and these guys are just bloody liars. It's sickening to hear it. I'm sorry. I guess really, I remember I knew people very well who were the poorest of the poor, and these are the most humble, decent, kind, and spiritual people in the world, the Mexican campesinos.
Wow. I agree with you. I agree with you wholeheartedly. The demonization of the poor for profit and political power.
The demonization of the poor. You know how Steinbeck put it back in the Depression? He said, "We became afraid of a man with a hole in his shoe."
Wow. So Lou Wexler is who Alifair is kind of dating. He's working on the film also. But Dave really doesn't like her dating Lou. He keeps telling her she's too young for him or he's too old for her. At the same time, he's falling in love with a woman that's probably 30, 40 years younger than him.
That's right, and that puts him as a parent in a very bad position. I think in another place, another novel, Dave Robichaux says, "Raising a teenage daughter is easy. It's just like being rope drug up and down the staircase twice a day."
I'm there. I know exactly how that feels.
Well, between 13 and 17, a father really earns his money.
Yeah, that's...
And, you know, there's no rage like a woman scorned. That's not quite right. There's no more dangerous outburst of anger than that of a teenage girl between 13 and 17. It's like Smiley's flamethrower.
Unfortunately, I've experienced it. I know what it is, but you've said the Robichaux novel and the New Iberia's Blues is the best Robichaux novels that you've ever written. What do you think makes these two novels so much better than what you've done in the past with Robichaux?
Well, gee, that's a good question. I don't know. Maybe with some age, I've learned to do it a little better. I'm finally catching on to the craft at age 82.
Well,
here's the big swindle when it comes to age. If you acquire any experience or wisdom, anyone who acquires age or experience discovers it's too late to use it. All the damage is done.
Yeah, but you put it in the book.
It's like
you put it in
like
the book.
Discovering the fire extinguisher after your house has burned down.
Yeah, but you can pass that fire extinguisher over to the house next door, which hasn't burnt down.
That's right, but he'll probably throw it your neighbor will throw it back at you and have you arrested for littering.
So yeah, these novels, all your stories, I feel your stories are moral tales. Actually, I look at all your Robichaud novels as moral tales.
Well, that's interesting because people often ask, why is it that many readers have enjoyed Dave Robichaud as a narrator of these 22 books? Well, he is the prototype of the form I use, the form of narration, is that of the everyman morality plays from medieval times. And, you know, everyman was the common man who explains to his audience the nature of the drama. And these were plays that were written to entertain a medieval audience, you know, in Europe. But he represents what's best in us. He's the blue collar knight errant, and again, I think as you said earlier, he tries to give voice to those who have done.
You've said the Robichaud novel and the New Iberia's Blues is the best Robichaud novels that you've ever written. What do you think makes these two novels so much better than what you've done in the past with Robichaud?
Well, gee, that's a good question. I don't know, maybe I've, with some age, I've learned to do it a little better. I'm finally catching on to the craft at age 82.
Well,
here's the big swindle when it comes to age. If you acquire any experience or wisdom, anyone who acquires age or experience discovers it's too late to use it. All the damage is done.
All your stories, I feel your stories are moral tales, actually. I look at all your Robichaud novels as moral tales.
Well, that's interesting because people often ask, why is it that many readers have enjoyed Dave Robichaud as a narrator of these 22 books? Well, he is the prototype of the form I use, the form of narration, is that of the everyman morality plays from medieval times. And, you know, everyman was the common man who explains to his audience the nature of the drama, and these were plays that were written to entertain a medieval audience, you know, in Europe. But he represents what's best in us. He's the blue collar knight errant, and again, I think as you said earlier, he tries to give voice to those who have done, and that he has seen what has occurred in his home state, his beloved state. He calls the state of Louisiana the great whore of Babylon, but he said he fell in love with her many years ago. But the damage done to the environment and the people, the work is not meant to vilify industrial culture or industrial people. But Dave indicates, you see, it doesn't have to be either or, that very often mistakes are made, you know, like the intrusion of salt water into the marshes of southern Louisiana. Well, the guys who cut those canals were taking oil out of the ground and creating jobs for people, but they didn't know at the time the deleterious nature of what they were doing. So it isn't, we don't want to act in a benighted way and make these guys some kind of antichrist. But we've reached a time when we have knowledge and we have alternatives. And I think that Exxon Mobil now is working, I know with my cousin, P.R. Portis Burke, who's I think he's president of the Louisiana chapter of Ducks. Was it Ducks Unlimited? But this big oil company is helping restore the wetlands around southwestern Louisiana. So, you know, there's an intelligent way to do things, and these men have the power and the ability to do it. And evidently, they're doing a lot of good now. So there's always a way to do things right. You know, it's just a matter of, you know, sometimes restraint. But, of course, you know, there are many who believe that, well, the earth's there for us to use in any fashion we will. I mean, right now, the rainforest in South America are endangered. We lose the rainforest, we're going to lose the air we breathe.
Well, look, it's always a pleasure to have you on the air, and always love reading your books.
Well, that's very nice of you, and you're very gracious, and I always enjoy being on your show. It's an honor. And can I give a shout-out, hello, to Marcia Ball in
sure.
Austin, Texas, my favorite lady blues pianist and a great person.